From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council South Asia Center and Washington Correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Oren Durell, Foreign Affairs Reporter for USA Today, and here are the issues. Greece offered a new plan to meet demands of creditors and persuade European leaders to approve a 3-year bailout to stabilize the Greek economy and keep the country in the European monetary system. The plan would increase sales and corporate taxes and overhaul the Greek pension system. In Vienna, nuclear talks with Iran passed another deadline with no agreement, and American Secretary of State John Kerry quoted President Obama as saying, "We can't wait forever for the decision to be made." And in Washington, Pentagon officials gave Congress a dismal outlook on the war in Iraq against Islamic State, and Military Chief Martin Dempsey cautioned against having U.S. troops fight alongside Iraqis. Quote, "If their spine is not stiffened by the threat of ISIL or their way of life, nothing we do is going to stiffen their spine." Well, Barbara, let me start with you. It looks like we won't know for a couple of days, but that the new Greek plan will be accepted and there will be a 3-year plan or a bailout that keeps Greece afloat and in the European Union monetary system.
Yeah, I think everybody kind of stared into the abyss and didn't like what they saw and realized that the price to European economies of Greece leaving the Eurozone would actually be greater than just continuing to give more loans, bailing out the Greek economy. You've had an interesting dynamic with the Germans kind of playing the bad cop and the French playing the good cop. Obvious concerns that if Greece were to leave, that other economies that are somewhat weaker, say, than Germany, including France, but especially countries like Italy, Spain, Portugal, that, you know, they might also have difficulties. The problem is that with one currency, it's very hard for countries to adjust their, you know, economies when they have problems. They can't devalue the currency to increase exports in the way, say, that happens, you know, with other countries. And, I mean, the Greeks are not obviously totally innocent in this. There are reforms that they should have imposed. They've not shown great discipline, certainly, in handling their affairs over the last few years. But the medicine that's been prescribed for them has just made the situation worse.
Oren, what about this? Are you optimistic that this plan will be accepted, go into effect, and Greece will be saved, in effect, economically?
I think it's hard to make a prediction. The fact is that they've proposed, apparently, will include some of the spending cuts that the creditors have asked for. It also includes some tax hikes, which the creditors do not want to see. But I think that there's hope that the spending cuts are more even than what the voters rejected in a referendum last weekend. That might be enough to get them this deal. I think the longer-term question is, you know, will the Greeks be able and willing to make the sacrifices that they really need to make in order to turn their economy around and to start moving forward again? They've been living a very kind of a cushy lifestyle, you know, a lot of very early retirement, and, you know, the debts have been mounting. The government isn't collecting taxes efficiently.
I'm always amazed that they get to retire at 50 in Greece. I can't even remember 50. Other people's case, too. But anyway, you can see why some nations look at this as, well, Greece, they borrowed this money and they spent it and they don't want to pay it back. But on the other hand, why is Greece so valuable? You said the European economy would suffer, but I mean, they're suffering anyway with this long-term drama involving Greece, and it may extend, it may happen in Spain, Italy, Portugal, those countries as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, Europe came late to the understanding that in a weak economic situation, more austerity is not necessarily good, that you really do have to, you know, shore up the economy, you have to buy bonds, you have to extend credit, because otherwise you get into this sort of death spiral. And, you know, Greek debt now is 170% of their GDP. One reason why it's so high is because the GDP is down by more than 20%. So you have to find a way to stimulate growth so that Greece will be able to pay its way out of this. That's the, you know, to find that sort of sweet spot where they're getting just enough credit so the economy can start to grow again and they can pay off their debt.
I don't think they've gotten there yet. As Oren mentioned, they're going to raise taxes, and they ought to cut taxes. That's the way you stir growth.
Well, they're going to raise the sales tax.
And corporate taxes.
They're going to change some of the pension benefits, and they're also going to cut their military spending, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Didn't know they had any.
Apparently they do. So, you know, there are some things that they can do, but they desperately have to find a way to get people to invest in Greece. And I think what's been so terrifying is that people have been basically going liquid over the last couple of weeks. They're taking their cash. They're buying everything they can buy, you know, appliances, cars, jewelry, whatnot, to have their assets in something concrete. Businessmen have actually been taking bucket loads of cash on airplanes to the rest of Europe to pay off, you know, their creditors so that they can continue to import goods into Greece. So they have to do something so that the banks can function normally again.
The situation there is so bad that it's causing tourism to take a nosedive. Greece, and that's the number one industry of the country. And very few tourists want to go to a place where if they have to stay there for any time over a week, they have to bring thousands of dollars in cash along with them. It's not safe because the banks are closed and they can't even use their credit cards at restaurants or hotels. So this cash problem is a very deep problem for Greece. And I wanted to also mention that the Greeks are being encouraged by some parties in Europe and in Russia to kind of go it alone and to not knuckle under to the demands of the European Union. You know, the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, has been making overtures to Greece, and the Nigel Farage of the UK Independence Party has been urging them to go their own way. And this is hurting the unity of Europe. So this is really something to pay attention to.
So Putin's helping again, huh? Time now for a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and Oren Dorel. Well, I don't know whether we need to say more about Greece. I wonder that in 3 years from now, we're going to wind up with the same thing in Greece. It doesn't seem to me that the plan that the creditors have insisted on, I would certainly fault them, is going to do what you talked about, Barbara, and that is to spur the Greek economy.
Yeah, well, at least hopefully Greece will get loans extended so that they'll be able to open the banks and, you know, begin to resume some normal economic activity, and it won't get worse. But this is, you know, this may be just kicking the can down the road for another few years.
Oren, I'm going to ask you a final question here. Wouldn't Greece be better off, well, probably if it had never gotten into the European Union and went back to their currency, and they, when they had an economic problem, as Barbara suggested, they could devalue the currency, and which is quite common, and then wouldn't be stuck with the euro monetary system that they're not really equipped exists with countries like Germany and France and England and so on?
You know, first of all, there are countries that did not join the euro who are, that are doing quite well.
Yeah, Britain is one.
Yes. The euro system has inherent faults and weaknesses in that it's a monetary system that crosses boundaries of countries where each country has its own economic policies and there's no central government to force a country to do what would be good for the economy of Europe. So, yeah, the euro itself has a structural problem.
Let's turn to the nuclear talks with the Iranians in Vienna. Mm-hmm. Barbara, you follow these more closely than most human beings. So they've reached a point where I think they've, they've gone past another deadline, and then they can take a few days off and come back. Where do we stand? It seems that they've decided everything about nuclear weapons. It's just things like sanctions and inspections and things like that that are left. But those are the hard part.
Yeah, well, look, this is a negotiation that's about a lot more than the nuclear issue. This is, I can't think of a previous negotiation that's gone on in 18 months now and intensively. Foreign ministers from, you know, six major powers plus Iran completely caught up in these kinds of negotiations and lower level experts working constantly, really, for the last 18 months. And there are a lot of other crises in the world. So why is this absorbing so much attention? It's because it's about more than the nuclear issue. It's about whether Iran will return to some sort of international legitimacy after 36 years largely as a pariah state. It's about how the region will react to a resurgent Iran. It's about how Iran would use sanctions relief. I mean, there are a couple sticking points that have to do with the schedule for relieving sanctions. What does Iran have to do before all the sanctions come off? There are sanctions on conventional arms imports and exports that were imposed as part of the effort to get Iran to restrict its nuclear program. Iran wants those restrictions all eliminated very quickly, but there is concern, particularly among Iran's neighbors across the Persian Gulf, that, you know, Iran will beef up Hezbollah and Hamas and various militias in Iraq and so on, and, you know, get more advanced weapons from Russia and China. Another problem has been that the unity of the so-called P5 plus one, five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, they've held up really well up until, you know, the last few days. Russia and China want this deal done, and they want to be able to sell weapons to Iran. So, you know, all of this is making the end game really torturous, and I have great sympathy for my colleagues in Vienna who are, you know, having to, I mean, this is worse than watching paint dry right now.
What do? Just hang around the hotel and see if anybody comes that they might, you know, pump for information or what?
Yeah,
I've done plenty of that in my life.
Yeah, and they have been inventing a game where they try to decide which actors and actresses would play the parts of the various foreign ministers and negotiators, and, you know, I think they're going a little stir crazy, but this is really fraught, and if there is a deal, it is a game changer for the region and beyond. So that's why it's so hard.
Oren, it certainly would be a game changer, but let's assume there is a deal. I sort of assume there will be one when you go this far. It's hard to turn back, but is there reason for optimism that the Iranians may change and become a more legitimate country and not sponsor terrorism and so on and do all the things that the U.S. in particular has complained about for the last 36 years?
So the administration seems to think so. They make an argument that an Iran that is engaged with the world and that is open to trade with the world will have to operate by international standards and international rules, and that increased trade will empower elements in Iran that are business people, that are non-military, and that support Iranian President Rouhani represents the moderate branch of government, and that this, especially over time, that this will create a more moderate Iran that's working together in concert with its neighbors and so on. That's one argument. But
that's an argument. Do you think it can happen?
Well, just this week, the hardliners in Iran have been making, not only hardliners, even President Rouhani has said that, you know, that the elimination of Israel is a major goal of the Iranian foreign policy. Others have said that Iran will never be a non-enemy to the United States. And, you know, apart from the rhetoric, the Iranians see President Bashar Assad in Syria as an ally and somebody that they need to keep in power. They see Hezbollah as their presence on the Mediterranean. They're supporting these Iraqi Shiite militias who are really the only effective fighting force other than the Kurds in Iraq against the Islamic State. We'll probably get to that later. So they have a lot of activities that they're doing, and there are a lot of people are saying that this $150 billion in cash that is sitting in foreign bank accounts that's seized right now, that when that's released, that at least part of it, and it's a lot of money, so even 1% would be a lot, that at least part of it will go to the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, and to support all these proxies that they're supporting in other countries.
Okay. Yeah, Barbara?
Yeah, just a couple points. First, they don't call for the elimination of Israel. The formulation is that Israel will disappear because it is not a, you know, a just state, because it mistreats the Palestinians. And
they say they use the word destruction. That's the word that I saw
in
the
news. It
will
be destroyed. It's, you know, it's important. They're not saying they will eliminate
Israel.
That's
a pretty fine point.
It's a fine point, but
I'm not sure I see the point.
They say Israel will disappear from the map. That's the formulation that Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic State, used.
Now, let me ask you the question I asked. Go ahead.
Also, we're getting toward the end of Ramadan, and the last Friday in Ramadan is a day called Quds Day in Iran, and this is the day when you have pro-Palestinian and very vehemently anti-Israel demonstrations that are organized by the government. So one should not confuse government propaganda with the sentiments of most Iranians, who frankly could care less about the Palestinian issue and are not anti-Semitic, at least when it comes to Jews.
Right, and the sentiments of average Iranians have very little to do with what the Iranian government actually does.
Yes and no. And I think, you know, that's something that, you know, the sentiments of the Iranian people are one of the things that are motivating these nuclear negotiations. So I don't think you can dismiss public opinion. But there is also the aspect that the hardliners in Iran are very worried that a nuclear deal means they're done and finished with, that Iran will open up, that there will be normal relations with the U.S. at some point, and they and their slogans will be wiped from the pages of history, shall we say. So there's an effort to, you know, show, no, no, we're still the Islamic Republic, we're still opposed to Israel, we can still chant death to America, we can still chant death to Israel, and negotiate with the great Satan, the United States, at the same time. So I think you have to sort of see this on multiple levels and understand the domestic political games that are being played.
Sure.
In terms of whether Iran would use extra funds to bolster its various proxies and partners, and we'll get to this, the fact of the matter is that the United States and Iran are supporting the same forces now against the Islamic State, and the only reliable boots on the ground right now against IS are Kurds and Shia.
It's time for another break for the moment, but we'll be right back with Issues in the News.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin of AlMonitor.com and Oren Durrell with USA Today. Oren.
My understanding is that this conflict that Barbara talks about between the hardliners in Iran and the more moderate leadership and the sentiments of the people, that this issue is why the arms embargo issue is so important in the nuclear talks, because the lifting of the arms embargo will give the hardliners what they need in order to continue to expand their influence abroad.
Yeah, I agree with that, absolutely.
Okay, good. We reached agreement. Now we're going to turn to another issue, and that's Islamic State and fighting them in Iraq in particular. And the outlook's fairly gloomy, at least from the Pentagon. And I thought of the things that were said there, the most important thing, Barbara, was what General Dempsey said. I think it echoes President Obama as well. Look, if the Iraqi forces aren't going to fight for their own country, there's nothing we can do to really stiffen their spine, as he said.
Yeah, well, actually, I just read a very interesting interview that General Dempsey did a few months back with a guy named Joe Collins, who's former military man, very astute, did it for the National Defense University. And Dempsey talked about, the original sin there, which was dissolving the Iraqi army and the aggressive de-Ba'athification that was pursued back in 2003 after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. He was basically making the point that the U.S., to try to create an entirely new military force for a country is very, very difficult. You need the bones of what was there before. And to try to sort of wipe the slate clean, begin anew, very, very difficult. So what you have now in Iraq, unfortunately, the former Prime Minister Maliki got rid of most of the competent Sunni generals and even some of the competent Shia generals in the Iraqi army and created a really hollow force. And the best fighters now are these popular mobilization units, Shia militias, which are wholly owned subsidiaries of the Iranian government and run by people who've been trained in Iran or very close to Iran. And then you've got the Kurds, and they're doing most of the fighting. If you look even in Syria, the thing that struck me most was when Defense Secretary Ash Carter said that the U.S. has managed to train only 60 vetted, moderate Syrian rebels to fight IS. 60. And the goal is 5,000 a year. I mean, it's pathetic. Who's doing the fighting in Syria that the U.S. is supporting? Kurds. Again, it's the Kurds, who were supported also by the Iranians.
When I was in basic training in the Army, in my platoon, there were more people than that. Oren?
So the problem in Iraq is that it's turned into a very sectarian country. There are Shiites. There are Sunnis. The army that was disbanded that Barbara is talking about was a Sunni army.
Well, it was mostly Shia. It was led by Sunnis, but it was mostly Shia, actually, in its rank and file.
When this Islamic State wave happened over a year ago now, the Sunni tribes, Iraqi tribes that joined them, said, this isn't ISIS. You guys are all missing it. This is a Sunni revolution, a Sunni tribal revolution. They've lost power, but they're still there. They've been overwhelmed by ISIS completely, and their people are still working with them to a degree, but those people are still there. And that the American strategy that helped to pacify or quiet the war in Iraq before the American withdrawal depended upon these Sunni tribes and their, what we called back then, they called it the Sunni Awakening. And there were these Sunni tribes who worked in concert with American troops against Al-Qaeda, which was the predecessor of ISIS. There's reason to believe that an effort like that could continue, but the problem is that the Shiite-led government in Iraq and its Iranian supporters really don't want that to happen. And they're leaning heavily on these Shiite militias. You know, whenever they move into areas, they tend to exacerbate the sectarian divides. So it's not expected that these Shiite militias are going to have a whole lot of success in Anbar province, which is mostly Sunni. There's going to have to be a Sunni element that's a partner with the West and with the Iraqi government if it's going to work with the Iraqi government. The Kurds have been very effective, but they are not that effective either in non-Kurdish areas. So the Kurds have control of their areas. The Shiites have control of their areas. Right now, ISIS has control of the Sunni areas. If that's going to change, it's going to require reaching out to tribal Sunnis in those areas.
Is there any reason, Barbara, to think that's going to change?
Well, not as long as I think, you know, Obama is president, because the missing factor here would be more American boots on the ground. There are only a few thousand in Iraq. I went to an event or listened to an event with Lindsey Graham, who is a senator from South Carolina and a Republican aspirant to the presidency, and he has a very hawkish view, and he wants to send another 7,000 American troops to Iraq. He wants to embed Americans in Iraqi army units to, you know, stiffen their spine, so to speak, to quote General Dempsey. He also wants to send Americans to fight in Syria. You know, this is a minority view right now, certainly in the country, and President Obama is trying to keep the number of Americans involved to a minimum. So I think the best you can see is a kind of containment strategy where you keep ISIS from spreading out of the areas that it's already in. Maybe you nibble at the edges a little bit, and the Kurds have been successful in doing that, particularly in Syria. But otherwise, it's very hard to see how you defeat them.
It does seem that, and not just based on what General Dempsey said in the last few days, but in general what the Pentagon has said in the last few years, the Pentagon doesn't want to send more troops there either.
No, and the army is reducing in size. It's going to go down 40,000 troops from 490,000 to 450,000, and possibly another 30,000 more if sequestration, which we can talk about, you know, continues. So, I mean, the army is getting smaller. The appetite for involvement in these conflicts is certainly smaller. And it's just unfortunate because it means these wars are just going to go on and on.
Well, not much reason for optimism. This is it seems to me it's going to be left for the next president.
Well, it seems like some of this will be left for the next president. The administration has been hinting, I guess, saying quietly that once, hopefully, they have an Iran nuclear deal, that will free them up to do more in these areas in Syria and in Iraq. That sort of lends credibility to something that people have been saying for a while, which is that the administration has been keeping a light hand on Syria, which is very important to Iran, because of the nuclear negotiations, so as not to complicate them.
I think the reason for it is not so much that as a fear that Syria goes the way of Libya, for example, that, you know, Assad, as horrible as he is, still represents some form of governance. And given the number of factions now contending in Syria and the number even of Sunni factions contending, that if you get rid of what remains of a central government, then the whole place just becomes one big, you know,
there's certainly
conflict
zone. A sentiment in the administration, in the Obama administration, that they want a transfer of power from the Syrian government to another government.
Right.
And they don't want the central power to collapse entirely.
Well, that did happen in Libya, and we know the result.
We know the result, and also we see the result in Iraq of sort of, as I said, wiping the slate clean. So it's tricky.
That is sort of the Stalin theory, that at least as bad as this leader is, at least he brings some order. But Assad doesn't bring much order, actually, in Syria. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council's South Asia Center, and Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Oren Durrell, foreign affairs reporter for USA Today. This program was produced by Carol Castile. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.